we're lucky enough this evening not only to host Ambassador O'Sullivan, but I should point out that the EU has joined the World Affairs Councils of America to make this program possible. And he's been traveling in the country, speaking to American citizens. Most recently, he was speaking to Bay Area students, and we're very grateful to be the beneficiary of his trip. So it's my opportunity, and it's my great pleasure to introduce him. Ambassador O'Sullivan has been in this role as EU ambassador to the U.S. for over about a year now. Is that right?
Exactly.
Just about a year. Before assuming this post, he served as COO of the European External Action Service, as Director General for Trade, as well as Secretary General of the European Commission. And I'm sure you all know the European Commission is really the policy-making body of the EU, on which all the heads of states and heads of government sit. Do I have that right? This is your moment to correct me.
It's more,
in the most
diplomatic way. It's more the executive of the European Union.
The heads of
state and government meet in the European Council, which is a policy decision body.
This is right. Thank you.
Close.
Good enough. He began his career in the Irish Foreign Ministry, which you'll see that, you'll hear that faint accent, and spent 4 years as in the Commission delegation in Tokyo. And so we hope to cover a range of issues of concern to both the EU and the U.S. And I thought I would just sort of start out with the concept of the EU. You know, at a time when, I mean, there's really sort of two different approaches to governance in the era of globalization, and one is this constant breaking down into smaller and smaller, sometimes ethnically specific units, which we're seeing around the world, and the other is to cede some sovereignty to join a larger order or a larger regime, and that's the choice that Europe took. Talk about the trade-offs that were accepted by its 28 member states.
Well, I think what we've been able to do in Europe is pretty unique in human history, because it's the first time that a group of sovereign states democratically have decided to pool sovereignty in order better to affect that sovereignty. It's born of the recognition that, in fact, you're not losing sovereignty, you're actually gaining it, because you can have a better impact, better outcomes for your citizens by pooling sovereignty in certain areas. On the other hand, we are also very conscious, and no one in Europe wants to homogenize Europe. Italians will remain Italians, Danes will remain Danes, Poles will remain Poles. Member states remain entirely free to have their own education systems, their culture, their language, even their way of doing business. But at the same time, by creating the largest economy in the world, by being the largest trading bloc, by being able to influence global events when we speak as 28 member states with one voice, we believe that not only do we improve our own economic and political prospects, but we're also better able to be a force for good in the world.
And there are a whole set of dangers, of course, that are faced that no one country can manage on its own. And so we'll talk about some of those. But let me first say, you know, the EU is not without its growing pains. Say something about what's going on with Britain right now. David Cameron has said he wants to negotiate a better deal, and they're going to put EU membership up for a referendum next year in the UK. What is he looking for? What is the UK looking for?
Well, you'd have to ask the British to define exactly what it is they want to achieve. I wouldn't dream to speak for them. I think, you know, going back to my earlier point, the creation of the European Union is not without controversy, and it's not without its opponents, because we are democracies. If I said to you that 100% of Europeans love everything the EU does, it would be completely untrue. Sometimes Brussels is held in just about as much respect in the rest of Europe as Washington is in the rest of the United States. Mm-hmm. The fact is that you know, there is controversy about how much sovereignty should be pooled. And there are people who think already too much sovereignty has been pooled and some should be taken back. Mm-hmm. And this debate rages in all our member states from time to time. It's a particular issue in the United Kingdom for the last couple of years, and they have finally decided, I think maybe wisely, to hold a referendum to try and resolve the issue for once and for all. And the Prime Minister has said he believes there are some adjustments to British membership that he wishes to see made, which he will then submit to a referendum and hopefully on that basis recommend that the UK should remain in the European Union. So that's the situation we're in. The negotiations are ongoing. I think Mr. Cameron is being cautious in revealing his full hand at this point for obvious reasons. I think everyone is extremely well disposed to try to be helpful. I think everyone would like the United Kingdom to remain in the European Union, but of course not at any price. But I'm confident that in this situation, as in previous situations, when Denmark voted against the Single European Act in 1986, when Ireland voted against the Lisbon Treaty, we've always found ways of patching things up, finding solutions and moving on. And it may look like a temporary setback, but the progress is always forward and always towards greater integration.
Now, there were critics who argued that the euro crisis demonstrated a fundamental flaw in the structure. But we're now seeing some real signs of recovery in many of these economies that seem to give a lie to that. Say something about where that recovery is, how things are doing in Italy, Portugal, and elsewhere, number one. But also Greece's decision, in fact, to accept the requirements of the third bailout, and your view is whether they'll be able to meet those requirements in the year ahead.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that the euro has been a great success. I mean, and it's important to understand why we went for a single currency. I remember very well the twin oil shocks of the 70s when we had separate currencies in Europe. And the first thing that happened was competitive devaluation of our currencies across all of Europe. It didn't benefit us economically. It was ultimately, it canceled itself out, because if one currency devalues, another currency devalues, it makes no difference. And people began to realize that since we trade 95% of what we trade between ourselves, having a single stable currency between us was the best solution. And so we built that single currency. It's the world's second reserve currency. It's been a strong currency. And for 10 years after its creation, we knew huge economic progress, low interest rates, economic growth, and lowest unemployment we've seen in many years in Europe. Then came the financial crisis, which then, of course, basically pushed several European economies literally over a cliff. And then we discovered, which some people had been commenting before, that we had not fully completed the process of economic and monetary union. We had a single currency, but we did not necessarily have all the tools and instruments you needed to make a single currency work between 19 countries. And we had to fix that. So we had to put in place increased surveillance of national budgets to make sure that no country could go on a path of unsustainable public finances. We had to create a banking union so that if banks got into difficulty, we had clear European rules about how they would be wound up and who would contribute to that and not just the taxpayer. And it took us several years to do that. And we've been fixing that over the last couple of years. That's why our crisis, to a certain extent, lasted longer than the US crisis, or did in the United States. We've now done that repair work. I think we've changed radically the architecture underpinning economic and monetary union with banking union. And now I think we're indeed showing strong signs of recovery across the entire European Union. And this is further accelerated by the fall in oil prices, by the quantitative easing of the European Central Bank, and by the consequent depreciation of the euro, which was not a policy objective, but which is giving an extra boost. And so indeed, we are seeing strong positive growth, and indeed some of the countries which were most hit by the crisis, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, are actually showing some of the strongest recovery and growth figures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, talk a little bit about Greece. It had to agree to, there's some real pain points there that it had to agree to in order to get the bailout that it received. What are the chances that it will meet those requirements?
Well, I think Greece had to go through a particularly difficult period of adjustment. And I think we have to acknowledge that amongst all the countries who were involved in the bailouts, Portugal, Ireland, to a different degree, Spain, linked mainly to banking, Greece probably suffered the greatest social consequences because it was a massive adjustment in the Greek economy. And this undoubtedly caused a lot of social pain, quick fall in salaries, reduction in public service employment. And this was difficult for the Greek people. They were actually, just before the elections before this one, they were actually turning the corner. You could see the benefits of the structural changes which Greece had made, and actually Greece was projected this year to grow quite strongly. But then a government was elected which said, we need to find a different way of doing this because the social consequences are too high. And there was a very difficult debate between Greece and the other partners in Europe as to how this was to be achieved. people were not necessarily opposed to doing it differently, but the math had to add up. We had to be able to balance the books at the end of the day, because no one was going to loan Greece money without guarantees that the structural reforms were going to be made, which would put Greece on a strong path of recovery. This cost a certain amount of time, but it was finally agreed. The government has now been re-elected on this basis. The government is now going forward on the basis of this program. And I think what's been agreed with Greece is a very strong basis for ensuring a recovery and a modernization of the Greek economy, which will place Greece very strongly in the next few years to see an economic turnaround and hopefully a lessening of some of the social pain, which we know the Greek people have had to take.
Had Greece left the Eurozone, what would have been the consequences, both in terms of precedent set, but also in its own right?
Well, to be very frank, I don't think this was ever seriously an issue. Nobody in Greece wanted to leave the Eurozone. And I think it's difficult, to be honest, to imagine a scenario where leaving the Eurozone would have been positive for Greece. They would have had to create a new currency. They would almost certainly have had to default on their loans. Greece is an economy which depends heavily on imports for survival, because it imports much of its energy, it imports much of its manufactured products. So the theoretical gain of a depreciation would have been very much offset by the huge increase in the prices of imports. So I don't think anyone in Greece actually saw a happy outcome for Greece out of leaving the euro. And I think this is why the government decided at the end that they would accept a bailout, which they initially had hesitations about because they did not wish to leave the euro. And I don't think the rest of Europe wanted Greece to leave the euro, but it is true. At one point, it was said, look, if you really can't reach an understanding about this issue, then maybe you'll have to contemplate leaving. But Greece quickly said, well, we don't want to leave, and they're staying in, and we're all glad that they're doing so. And I think it's the right choice for Greece and the right choice for Europe.
So I won't press you to answer a hypothetical, but let's move on to growing the economies, because that is obviously a very high priority for the EU. Trade plays a big role in this. We've got TTIP. The negotiations are going on as we speak, I believe, on what would be a trade agreement between the US and the EU. Tell us how this agreement, once reached, will affect the everyday lives of Europeans. What will it mean by way of new export jobs, new opportunities?
Well, I think you have to put this in a certain context. I mean, firstly, you're absolutely right that growing the economy is the big challenge for Europe. And this commission under President Juncker has set itself the objective of growth and jobs. And they have a very clear agenda, starting with the investment plan of boosting investment, starting with capital markets union to increase venture capital, less dependence on bank-based capital for companies, which is an important structural issue in the European economy, energy union to create a genuine single energy market across the 28 member states, which will have important security benefits, but also important economic benefits, and the digital single market, which is really to boost the digital economy in Europe and to break out of 28 closed digital spaces across our member states. And in addition to that, we have a very ambitious trade agenda. We've had our economic difficulties, but it's important to remember that the European Union is the largest economy in the world. When America and China debate over who has the biggest economy, you're arguing for second and third place. We're the largest trading bloc in the world. So we have had a substantial surplus on manufactured products for the last 10 years. So we're doing some things right in Europe, but we have to build on those strengths. And trade is a very important part of it. And we have a very ambitious trade agenda with the rest of the world. We've concluded recently a very ambitious trade agreement with Canada. We've concluded with Singapore. We've just concluded with Vietnam. We're negotiating with Japan, with Malaysia, with Thailand, with India. We're upgrading our free trade agreement with Mexico, with Chile, and we're negotiating with Mercosur, which is a strong bloc in Latin America. That's just to give you a sense of the context in which we now turn to the transatlantic agreement, which the transatlantic economic corridor is the largest and most important economic corridor in the world, bar none. We are both much more heavily invested in each other than either of us are in any other part of the world, including Asia, important though Asia is for both of us. To give you an example, American companies make more money out of their investments in Belgium than they do out of their investments in China. It's just an illustration. And so it seems only natural in this context that we would build a free trade agreement between us, reducing tariffs and hopefully eliminating as many tariffs as possible, opening up services, opening up government procurement, but just as importantly, diminishing the red tape of doing business across the Atlantic through overlapping regulatory regimes, particularly in areas like automobiles, medical devices, pharmaceuticals, chemical products, where we have the same very high standards of consumer protection, consumer safety, and health. But very often, we require companies to do the same tests twice on both sides of the Atlantic in order to market their products. It's not a question of diminishing standards, not a question of lowering them, but it is a question of simply reducing the cost of doing business. Now, you asked me, and I'm not running away from the question, what will people see in their daily lives? To be very honest, trade agreements, you don't really feel it on a day-to-day basis when you walk into a supermarket. You feel it across the whole economy. Trade basically reduces the cost of imports. Mm-hmm. Everyone talks about exports in trade. 60% of what we import in Europe is an input to something that we export. Mm-hmm. So lower price of imports is actually an important boost to the economy, just as much as calculating the exports. So, European citizens, in short, will see better value for money. We will see European companies able to expand and develop. There'll be job creation. There will certainly be some job losses, because trade is not only about winners, but also about adjustments, and we have to be honest. But the benefits will outweigh the disadvantages, and globally, both the United States and Europe will see their economies grow and their economic prospects grow.
Now, there is some opposition, some popular opposition.
Indeed.
I think a petition was signed by something like 3 million people calling for the end of TIP negotiations. Tell me what concerns they're putting forth. Does it relate to the questions of standards that you were just talking about?
Well, I can't put myself in the head of 3 million people and tell you why they signed a petition. I think my biggest difficulty in this is this trade agreement does not yet exist. It is a negotiation. So when people say to me, I'm against this trade agreement, I say, which trade agreement? And they say to me, well, the one that's going to force us to lower our standards, that's going to mean our food safety standards will be lower, that our public services will be forced to privatize, that we will have American companies dictating what European governments can do. I say, well, if that's the trade agreement we're negotiating, I'm against it too. Show me where I sign. People can attribute to this negotiation all kinds of fears, but the facts are quite different. This is the most transparent trade negotiation we've ever run. The mandate on which we are operating as the European Commission on behalf of our member states is public. We've set out the objectives we wish to pursue. The Americans have stated many, many times what they want to achieve. And in none of this do either of us think for one moment that we could get democratically approved by our respective constituencies, either in Congress or in the European Union, an agreement which lowered standards, which damaged the environment, which damaged consumer safety. None of our peoples would ever approve this. So we're not going to produce such a deal. But when someone says, I've signed a petition against it because I know that that's really what you're trying to do, I don't know how you argue with that, other than to say, why don't you wait and see? When we finish the negotiation, this will be submitted. In the European case, it will have to be approved unanimously by the 28 member states, by a majority of the European Parliament, and by every single national parliament. Now, more democratic legitimacy than that, I don't know how you create it. So to the people who say I'm against this negotiation, I say, well, I think you're against a phantom. You're against an imaginary negotiation that isn't happening. And they say, well, it's all happening behind closed doors. Prove to me the contrary. I say, wait until you see the outcome. And I can guarantee you, it may not be the best deal in the world, because somebody will obviously find something to dislike about it, but it will be subject to full democratic scrutiny and approval. And we know, and Mike Froman knows, negotiating for the United States, and Cecilia Malmström knows, negotiating for Europe, if they bring back home something which is open to the allegation that it has lowered standards, that it has diminished the ability of government to regulate in the areas we believe are important, that it has in some way compromised consumer rights or labor rights or environmental standards, it will not be approved. And no trade negotiator wants to negotiate a deal that doesn't get approved.
And then there are issues on our side, on the U.S. side. Are you at all worried that the agreement, that the negotiations will be caught up in and set back by our own presidential politics in an election year?
Look, we've been negotiating for 2 years, just over 2 years. We started in July 2013. But before that, we had a process of about 1 year intense joint preparation in which we did studies and a high-level expert group outlined what the parameters of a deal could look like. So we weren't starting from scratch when we started in 2013. Typically, a deal of this kind, the deal with Canada took 5 years. You've just completed, and we're very pleased to see that, the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiation, which you've been doing for 6 years. So to finish next year in the life of this administration by the 20th of January 2017, it would be a quick negotiation for a negotiation of this ambition. But it's not impossible, and it's what we're trying to do. Now, of course, we're conscious that next year is an electoral year, a general election for the president, and also the congressional elections. So we know that this will have a certain effect. If we haven't succeeded in concluding this negotiation under this administration, it'll probably take a little time for the new administration to set themselves up and resume the negotiations. Mm-hmm. So it would set us back 6-9 months in terms of the negotiation. But I believe that if we can't do it with this administration, which is our intention and our wish, that we will be able to resume with the new administration and complete it reasonably quickly afterwards, still in a time frame which is reasonable for this kind of negotiation. But I emphasize, we would like to do it still with this administration, if at all possible.
You mentioned the digital economy. There's been a recent, we've had an agreement, I think, since 2000 that allowed a kind of streamlined process for certification of U.S. companies operating in Europe to be able to transfer personal data back to the U.S. That agreement has been struck down by the highest court. What does that mean? What next? Will we see digital commerce grind to a halt?
No, I don't think we're going to see digital commerce grind to a halt. There are many other ways in which data can legally be transferred. It may be slightly more complicated for the companies currently using the safe harbor arrangement, which no longer is valid. That some adjustment may be required, and we certainly want to help companies understand as quickly as possible how data flows can continue. It is true that this does create a new situation. We have to digest the consequences of the court decision. We have been working with the American authorities on an update of the arrangement because it did date from 2000, and to be honest, a lot has happened. That's 15 years ago. We were on the verge of concluding the negotiation. Now this court judgment has intervened. I think we need a little time out to digest the implications of the court judgment so that any new arrangement which we come forward with, and it is our intention to continue the discussions to have a new form of safe harbor, has to be fully in conformity with what the court has said, in particular about the respect of fundamental rights to data privacy under the European treaties, which is the entitlement of our citizens. So we need to just make sure that any new agreement is fully in line with the law as laid down by the court. This is going to take a little bit of time. I don't want to put a precise figure on it, but we need to be sure that whatever we produce next is correct. But we are both committed, both the United States and the European Union, to maintaining these data flows, which are in the best interests of your companies, of our people. By the way, many of these companies are heavily invested in Europe. They're almost European companies. So this is not an us and them. It's a common dilemma. We have to face this together and find a way forward which respects your legal order, our legal order, and which enables digital commerce and data flows to continue in a legal way, fully respecting the rights of our citizens.
To what extent are public attitudes in Europe toward privacy and us and the U.S. with regard to privacy shaped by the Snowden revelations?
I think it would be wrong of me to say anything other than the fact that the Snowden revelations did come as a bit of a shock to people in Europe. I mean, you can say that that's naive, that perhaps they should always have known that everyone's spying on everyone else. But the extent of that surveillance, including, you know, Chancellor Merkel's private mobile phone, it just seemed surprising. As I think Chancellor Merkel herself said, between allies, why are we expending energy spying on each other when we actually have, you know, other people that maybe we should be more worried worried about. So there was a sense of disappointment, of surprise, and particularly, for example, in Germany, I think it was deeply felt of somehow, well, how can this happen between friends? I think the United States has moved on since then. This administration has done a lot to reform the American system of surveillance. The Freedom Act is a new legislative base, and it is different from the previous legislation. And I think we understand that the United States takes very seriously the issue of privacy, of data protection. But in both in the United States and in the EU, we have to find ways of reconciling the rights of citizens to privacy, the importance of data protection, and the overriding needs of security, because security is also a human right. We want the right to privacy, but we also want the state to protect us from terrorists or from criminal acts. So we have to get that balance right. Maybe we get it slightly differently right on either side of the Atlantic, but the issue is not to let those differences of approaches operate in a way that it prevents particularly economic activity between us. And that's the common commitment on both sides of the Atlantic.
Staying with the economy for just a bit longer, labor markets. There's a real problem in Europe and having sort of aging societies and a shrinking labor base. What role does immigration play in resolving that particular challenge?
Well,
I say this in particular since you're originally from Ireland, and Ireland had opened its doors to immigration from former Warsaw Pact countries.
Well, we also had a strong tradition of emigration. Yeah. As you know, there are some 45 million people in the United States claim Irish origin. So we've done our bit for the United States as well.
Thank you.
But I think there is an issue in Europe of demographics. I think migration or immigration can and should play a role in addressing that. But frankly, you can also address it through public policy. If you look at Sweden, if you look at France, they have changed their public policies, particularly as regards childcare, particularly as regards paternity leave, particularly as regards more equal burden sharing in the workplace and at home between men and women, enabling more women to both have families and work. And they have changed the demographics. They've actually changed the numbers of replacement. So it's not, you know, we are not condemned only to solve the problem through immigration. But I fully accept that immigration should play a part in it. I personally believe that immigration is a huge positive. I think that immigrants always contribute much more to societies than they take out of it. The notion of immigrants as somehow exploiting the countries to which they move is a gross caricature, and this is true universally. So I think we should welcome immigration in Europe, but we have to accept that there are also issues of absorption, of integration, and of the fact that you are a country built on immigration. Everybody here has come from somewhere else. Not now, but I mean going back historically. Even now, I'm astounded at how many Americans describe themselves in terms of where their parents or their grandparents came from, even though they may have been born here or even their parents were born here. They will still say, I'm Italian-American, I'm African-American, I'm Hispanic-American. People are very attached to the identity that comes from that rather than just saying they're American. Europe is much more complicated. We've had nationalities going back thousands of years. I mean, there are people whose families have lived in the same villages for many hundreds of years. So the notion of somebody coming from outside and moving in is slightly more complicated than it maybe is in a society which is built on diversity and difference. So I think we also have to accept that the politics of immigration in Europe is going to be slightly more complicated. Mm-hmm. And we face that, and it is an issue which is difficult in some countries. Some countries fear that immigration can somehow dilute their cultural identity or can change the character of the country. I personally think many of these fears are not founded, but they are a political reality that we have to take into account. So the balance has to be struck between the fact that we need immigrants, for the fact that immigrants contribute positively to society, but there is also a political limit to how much immigration could be absorbed in any given country at any given moment. Well, now, of course, I imagine we're going to lead into the whole issue of refugees and asylum, but of course that's a slightly different issue than the issue of immigration.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with the issue of immigration for the moment and ask the question, because you're talking about the politics of immigration, whether you're seeing the rise of xenophobia in the face of, because what the immigration has been going on in a continually accelerating fashion into Europe, and Europe's demographics are changing enormously. What are you seeing in terms of domestic politics, in terms of more right-wing groups gaining favor, just in their response to change, period, and to the change as it's demonstrated through immigration?
Look, I think we are experiencing a certain disillusion amongst our population with the policies which have been followed for the last 20 or 30 years, which have, in my view, been at the source of our economic success. But we've just come through one of the worst financial and economic crises. We have very high unemployment. We have concerns about the impact of globalization, a sense amongst some people that somehow we're losing control over the national environment, whether that's to the European level or whether that's to the global level. And all of this gets mixed into a sort of amalgam mm-hmm. of unhappiness with the status quo, which is reflected in some extremist parties. Yes, we have to acknowledge that. I think we need to be cautious in overestimating the impact of these parties. In most cases, they are far from ever achieving power or ever actually wielding any real political influence. But yes, they're there. They exploit, if you like, this sentiment of unease in the population. And we have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge that this sentiment of unease is there. And I think it is a challenge to the established parties to find ways of bringing those people back into more established politics. And that's what people are trying to do across Europe. So I think, yes, it's an issue, but I just think sometimes viewed from, I think Americans worry more about it than perhaps we do in Europe, because we relativize it. We understand that these are parties that are going through temporary phenomena of increased popularity, but in no country do they ever really look like gaining any serious political power, because at the end of the day, people tend back towards the center and moderate positions, and that tends to be the sort of center of gravity in most of our member states.
So you referenced this sudden influx of migrants and asylum seekers from Syria, from Iraq, even as far as Afghanistan, and of course Eritrea as well. Talk about what the European Commission's response has been to the asylum seekers, because they did come to a view on the relocation of those for whom it was very clear, or is very clear, that they need those protections. What arrangements have been put forth?
Well, I think I need to maybe just back up a little and emphasize what this distinction between migrants and asylum seekers. Asylum seekers are people who basically knock on our door saying, I'm under threat, I'm in a situation of civil war or threat of violence for my family, I need asylum, I need protection. And in those circumstances, unlike with migrants whom you can admit or not admit, in the case of asylum seekers, we have signed up to international conventions which require us immediately to offer such people shelter, decent conditions, shelter for their families, food, medical treatment, even some financial assistance, while we process their claim, while we assess whether they are indeed true asylum. Would it be putting their lives at risk or their safety at risk if we sent them back to the country from which they came? And if the answer is yes, then they have to be granted asylum, and they have to be equally given the necessary means whereby to live and to feed their families and to live in decent conditions. This is a complex process. Typically in Europe, it takes about 4 months. In the United States, by the way, it takes 2 years to make this assessment. But meanwhile, you have to look after these people. Now, we have system. Our system was that the country where you first arrived started the processing.
That's so the Dublin.
That's the Dublin, what we call the Dublin Agreement, which means that the country where you first present your application is the country which processes the application. If your application is approved, you can we could then discuss resettlement in another European country, perhaps. But the for the first phase of the assessment, you stay in the first country where you first arrived, and this has worked very well. When we've had, I would say, you know, normal numbers of refugees, which we've had over many years, and our member states are well able to cope. We then have the collapse of authority in Libya. We have the civil war in Syria, the massive displacement. I mean, there are 11 million displaced Syrians, 7 million within Syria, 4 million in the neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. And these people have been there for several years in difficult conditions, and many of them start to say, hey, I'm going to go to Europe. And unfortunately, there was a well-constructed smugglers ring that would take them eventually into Libya and then onto boats across the Mediterranean. And for the last year or so, the Italian government and people, I must say, have done a fantastic job of rescuing people at sea on their own, of welcoming these people, but also saying, hey, we need some help. These numbers are, and these people actually don't want necessarily to come to Italy, they're trying to get to Europe as a whole. Mm-hmm. Finally, it was decided that we needed a European intervention, so we set up a European search and rescue operation, which has saved many thousands of lives. We have set up a naval force to try to prevent the smugglers from pushing people out onto unseaworthy vessels. And we have now agreed, because Greece then found itself similarly inundated, and Greece was even less equipped than Italy to cope because of what we've just discussed about the Greek economy. Though I want to pay tribute to the generosity of the Italian and Greek people, notwithstanding all the economic difficulties, they opened their homes, their schools, their town halls. They gave food and shelter to these thousands and thousands of people. The island of Lesbos in Greece, typically there's 2,000 or 3,000 people live there in the winter, in the summer maybe 20,000 tourists, and they suddenly found they had nearly 25,000 refugees. Obviously they can't cope. So we needed European action, and what we've done is firstly commit resources to help the frontline countries process the applications and to better cope with the numbers, and we've agreed, not without some controversy, to reallocate 160,000 of these asylum seekers to other countries for processing, so that they will not just be processed in the frontline states, but they will be distributed across all the member states of the European Union in a gesture of solidarity. We need to do this. We need to work on trying to improve the conditions in the neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. We're complaining. I mean, we've had about 750,000 refugees into the EU this year. It's quite a large number. Lebanon is a country of 4 million people, and they've had 1 million refugees. So they need help.
One out of four.
Exactly.
People.
They need help. The UN agencies have basically run out of money. The European Union and its member states, we are the largest donors of humanitarian aid to those three countries, along with the United States, which is the second largest donor. But we need others to step up and contribute to making it possible for these people to live in decent conditions in these three countries while we try and fix the problem in Syria, which of course is a whole other issue. So we need to act on all of these levels. And we also need, and the European Commission has promised this, we need to revisit our whole system in Europe of managing external frontiers, of managing asylum seekers, of distributing them more equitably across all our member states, and not having those member states who find themselves in the front line of a sudden surge of asylum seekers having to bear the full burden.
You reference the kind of heartwarming response of citizens on a Greek island who would swim out to rescue individuals. There's a story of German citizens
exactly.
standing and applauding as asylum seekers came in by train into their country. Juxtapose that with Hungary's decision to put up a barbed wire fence. Very recently, Prime Minister Renzo of Italy rebuked the Hungarians, saying, in essence, that decision, that the greatest threat to Europe is not austerity and the euro crisis. The greatest threat to Europe is not the influx of migrants. The greatest threat to Europe is putting up a barbed wire fence. Is he right?
Well, I think he's right that putting up barbed wire fences won't solve the problem. I think maybe we just need to understand a little bit the situation in which the Hungarians felt they found themselves, which is they have very open frontiers. I mean, there isn't really a clearly delimited frontier. And suddenly, once we stabilize the situation in the Mediterranean, people discover that if you kind of walked through the Balkans and you turned up in Hungary, there was almost nothing to stop you just walking into the EU and keeping going to Germany or Sweden. So there was an issue of having some semblance of order at the external frontier. Now, I think we all agree that, you know, the way in which it was maybe managed and presented was perhaps sending the wrong kind of signals, and I'm not disagreeing with your point that I don't think anyone thinks putting up barbed wire fences solves the problem. On the other hand, I think it's also clear we cannot have entirely porous external frontiers across which people simply walk at will. We need a process. We have to respect our international obligations, but we also have to have some order and structure in the way in which we receive immigrants. So I think the Hungarians, I think were in a difficult situation. I think they could perhaps have managed it slightly differently. I don't want now to go into too much detail about individual countries, but I think we all understand that we need a common European response. It has to be a generous response in terms of our reception of asylum seekers, but we also have to demonstrate to our European citizens, all our European citizens, that we do actually have the situation under control, that the border is not completely porous, and that there is a process and an orderly way of managing a generous acceptance of asylum seekers.
You referenced the EU's giving to the United Nations agencies and support to the frontline states, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey. The same is true of the United States. But we've taken in a fraction of the migrants. I mean, I think it's under 1,000 people at this point. What else should the U.S. or others be doing in the face of, and is this the subject of conversations you have in Washington?
Yes. Firstly, every country has to decide how many people they think they can take in. I think the United States is now offering to take 100,000 between now and the end of 2017. But we also understand that, I mean, for very good reasons, the United States is not going to accept people in numbers which make a huge dent in the numbers we're going to receive in Europe. It's our neighborhood. We've got people. It's much easier to walk from the camps in the Middle East to Europe than it is to try and get to the United States. And that's just the facts. So I think our main ask of the United States is firstly to continue to be a generous donor to the UN agencies, to help us put pressure on other countries who potentially have the funds to contribute. I'm thinking particularly about the other Arab states, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. It's clear these countries are not necessarily going to accept, and they've been clear they don't want to accept many asylum seekers, but I think they could contribute more generously to the UN agencies looking after the people who are displaced in Lebanon, Hungary, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, and we're working very closely with the United States in trying to fix all the international situations which are at the origin of this, whether this is Libya, where we recently had good news, or it's Syria, where frankly the situation has, if anything, become a bit more complicated.
So I have two question cards regarding this issue, and one asks whether the migrant crisis was inevitable, whether there was some way in which the EU could have somehow softened the blow. And I would think what's behind this question is the question of whether the impact on frontline states could have been lessened at the time, thus making Europe less of a draw. But I may be wrong about what was behind the question. Is there a way that EU could have softened the blow and avoided this crisis?
Well, I don't think we could have avoided the crisis, because the crisis isn't of our making. The crisis originated in Syria, at least in its most immediate form, and the displaced people. And since it's our neighborhood, you know, we were the destination of preference for people wanting to seek asylum. Where else are they going to go? So we were inevitably going to be the magnet that would attract many of these people once they decided that they had no future either in Syria or that after several years of living in difficult conditions in the neighboring countries, that they lost hope and they decided, listen, we just go to Europe. So I don't think that we could have softened the blow. I think, as always, we could perhaps have had common European action more quickly.
That's
yes,
probably.
But
more.
That, you know, unfortunately, you know, Winston Churchill used to say of the Americans, you can always rely on them to do the right thing, but only after they've exhausted all the alternatives. And I sometimes think you can say that about Europe. We always end up doing the right thing, but only when we've tried everything else. And unfortunately, it's true, I can't deny this, that there was an extent to which those member states not directly affected by this were inclined to say, do we really have to deal with this? And it was only when it became a more acute crisis that it then everyone was galvanized. And I think the response since then has been hugely positive and shown a lot of European solidarity. But in an ideal world, we would have organized ourselves differently at an earlier stage.
So I'm going to take you to Syria itself. In order to find a diplomatic solution, we need both the Russians and the Americans at the table. So, number one, what are the chances they will come to the table, particularly given recent events? And number two, in a negotiation, what would be the goal? Would it be a multi-sectarian state? Is that within the realm of possible? Would it be partition, as folks have often mentioned with regard to Iraq? Or would it just be a minimalist approach that just says, make Syria safe for Syrians?
Well, I'm not an expert on the subject, and I would hesitate to sort of give you a clear blueprint. I think, firstly, the most important thing is to try and stop the violence, because this is what's absolutely decimating the country. The Assad government has been killing its own people. ISIS has been wreaking havoc. And this civil war is destroying the country. I mean, it'll take generations to rebuild Syria, even if we stop now. So I think the first thing is to stop the violence. Then we need some kind of political process to let Syrians decide what kind of future they want. I don't think it's up to the rest of us to come with a plan and say, this is how we think you should save your country. I think we need to create a process in which the Syrian people can somehow come together and say what future they want for their own country. And that's the challenge. And this is not easy. We need the cooperation of all the players in the region to make that possible. And they all need to do it, and this is the tricky bit, in, you know, a disinterested way. In other words, they all need to, I mean, the priority for all of us should be to let the Syrians decide that the future of Syria, because I think this is very important. Now, I don't know what the Syrians will make of the country that they now inherit after this tremendous conflict and all the bad feeling there must be on all sides as to who's done what to whom. But I think somehow we have to stop the violence, we have to create a political process, and we have to be, all of us, committed to allowing the Syrians to decide the future of their own country.
Are you concerned about the depopulation of Syria at this point? The future entrepreneurs, the future managers, the future political leaders, you know, those who've had, had their tertiary education interrupted by this war?
No, this is the greatest humanitarian crisis of our generation. That's clear. I mean, we've never seen such devastation in a country in such a short period of time. As I said, 11 million displaced people, but also just the destruction and the slaughter of innocent people that's taken place over the last 4 years is an absolute tragedy. And it's a tragedy that the international community has not been more able to unite behind trying to stop this. But that's, you know, we are where we are, and the question is now, how do we fix it, and how do we stop the violence and create a political process which enables the Syrian people to decide the future of their own country, and which enables them, which will require a huge effort, financial effort from all of us, to help them rebuild their country once they get a stable political process in place, because they're going to need a lot of help to rebuild.
Russia's got a role in this, as do we. Russia,
and
of
other
course,
actors as well.
And other actors. Ukraine is another important issue on the agenda of the EU. You've had sanctions on Russia because of the because of their actions in Ukraine. We need Russia for a Syria response. What are the chances that those that those sanctions, the European sanctions, will hold when they're to be released in, I think they run out in December of this year, in January. Will they hold?
They are linked exclusively to the success or failure of the Minsk process. We have, through the auspices of Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande, with the Russians and the Ukrainians, set out a clear roadmap for ending the violence in Ukraine, for restoring the territorial integrity of Ukraine, but also for acknowledging some elements of regional autonomy of the Russian-speaking regions. In a roadmap which is agreed by all the parties, including the Ukrainian government in Kiev and the Russians. And what we have said is, if and when this is fully implemented, including restoration of full control of the external frontiers by the Ukrainian government, then we will lift the sanctions. If we are satisfied that the, if you like, Russian interference in Ukraine's internal affairs is over and we have a satisfactory outcome. That is the criterion for the lifting of the sanctions. And that is what we are working towards. We've had a little success in the sense that the possibility of holding premature local elections in the separatist regions has been postponed. There will now be all Ukraine local elections, which is part of the Minsk agreement. Yeah. The Kiev government is working very hard at implementing its responsibilities under that agreement. We look to the separatist regions and to the Russians to implement theirs, including withdrawal of weapons and so forth. If that process continues and reaches a successful conclusion, we will then consider the lifting of the sanctions. If that is not the case, the sanctions will have to remain, and that's the European position. And we have managed to maintain not only European unity on this issue, but also strong transatlantic unity on this issue. And I would just point out, for an American audience, that this has come at a much higher economic cost to Europe than to the United States. These sanctions are much more expensive to what we trade 15 times more with Russia than you do. There's been retaliatory sanctions against particularly the countries, the neighboring countries of Ukraine by Russia, which have taken a heavy economic toll. But we bear this burden willingly in the best interests of trying to promote the sovereignty and better future for the people of Ukraine. And we will continue that policy until such time as the Minsk arrangement is fully implemented.
So there was another issue area where EU and US were together, and that was on the Iran nuclear deal.
A good news story.
And that was a situation, again, involving sanctions.
Yes.
So in exchange for lifting sanctions, they would forego uranium enrichment to allow them to build a nuclear weapon. Some pundits said that the sanctions would not have held absent an agreement. Were they right?
Well, I think, again, if I may, just to remind American listeners that it was mainly the European sanctions that was the game changer in terms of bringing Iran back to the table. When we introduced additional sanctions in 2012, we were, you know, trading much more with Iran, and the ban on Iranian oil imports, by the way, which affected, for example, very dramatically a country like Greece, which at the time was heavily dependent on cheap Iranian oil imports, or a country like France, which was, you know, one of the major car exporters to Iran, and which has seen factories close because of these sanctions. And we did that because we wanted to contribute to an international effort to explain to Iran that under no circumstances would we tolerate the acquisition of military nuclear capabilities. And we maintained those sanctions all throughout the negotiations. Speculation that they would end, the speculation that they would end would be that having negotiated a good deal, and this is a good deal, if America then rejected that deal, which some people in Congress seem to suggest, then I think there would have been questions about, well, why should we maintain the sanctions if, having solved the problem potentially, one of the international partners walks away, which would have been the case had the United States failed to agree. Happily, this is not the case. The United States has approved the deal. The deal has now gone through. I think that it's a success. It's a success for American diplomacy. I think President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry deserve great credit. I think great service was done to this country by wonderful civil servants like Wendy Sherman. But I also think it's an international success, and if I may say so, a European success, because as you know, the talks were chaired by the European Union, Federica Mogherini. We contributed substantially to the technical aspects of the negotiations, and of course, three of our member states were part of the six-party talks. So I think this is a success of international diplomacy, where we even held together a coalition, including China and Russia, at a time of tension over other issues, because we were all committed to this very important objective of making it impossible for Iran to acquire military nuclear capabilities. Yeah.
This past Sunday, just as the Iranians were putting the broad contours of the agreement to their legislature, they tested a missile that, in theory, that some are arguing could carry a nuclear warhead. I actually don't know the facts. I don't know if that's been confirmed. What did you make of that?
Well, I'm like you. I'm not entirely, you know, I would like more details of exactly what has happened. I think we just need to be clear that this deal, which we've concluded, was about preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. It was not about everything else that Iran does. Iran does many things that we continue not to like, whether it is, you know, what they say about Israel, whether it is financing terrorism in neighboring countries, whether it is the unpleasant language they use about Americans, whether it is the detention of Americans. All of these things we have profound disagreements with Iran about, and we still have them. And we will continue to have them. We haven't suddenly decided that now we're best friends with Iran. But we negotiated a deal which had one very specific objective, which is to prevent Iran from acquiring a military nuclear capability. And everything we say about Iran would be radically changed if, in addition to all of these things, they were sitting on top of a nuclear weapon. And that was what we've taken away. Then we have to deal with all the rest of the relationship with Iran, which is complex and difficult, and we will continue to be critical of what they do in human rights, in interference in the region, in anti-Israeli sentiments, and so forth. We continue to have profound disagreements with this regime, but we have solved one important issue, which would have dramatically changed the balance of power in the Middle East if we had not done that.
Turkey. Turkey has just experienced one of the worst terrorist attacks.
Tragedy.
When two suicide bombers set off bombs that killed, I think, 97 people, yes. Most of whom were Kurds, in a peace rally. And that experience seemed to have revealed or, I don't know, put it underscored some of the sectarian divisions that exist in Turkey and a distrust of the government as well. When you see those kinds of tensions, that kind of tragedy and that kind of response, is that an argument for engaging Turkey in a larger order like the EU, just as it's been engaged in NATO and OECD, or is it an argument against?
Well, I think it's an argument for engaging with Turkey. Turkey is a hugely important country and a hugely important player in the region, and the future of Turkey is very important to all of us. On the other hand, membership of the European Union is not like just joining any other international organization. Membership of the European Union is a binding together of our destinies, which both sides have to be fully committed to. And this is a process of negotiation which requires the countries seeking to join to make adjustments to their legislation, to their governance, to their whole way of doing business in order to meet the requirements of membership. We're in the middle of that process with Turkey. And we have some challenges in it, as you know, not least complicated by the relationship with Cyprus and the continued occupation of northern Cyprus. So that process is self-contained. And we will continue to engage, we'll continue to have the negotiations. When and how that will successfully conclude, we've never yet launched an enlargement negotiation with a country that has not succeeded. The only time is when the country itself decides not to pursue it, as was the case with Norway twice, when we successfully concluded that they an enlargement treaty, and then they decided on their own authority that they didn't actually want to go through with it, but normally an enlargement negotiation succeeds. But Turkey is a large and complex partner in this process, and it's going to take some time to get it right and to reach that point. So I don't. In the meantime, we have to continue to have relations with Turkey, which evolve in function of the situation in the region, and which take into account all the complexities that you've just been discussing. So I think these are. I'm not saying they're two completely separate things, but I think the. Fact is, the process of engaging with Turkey in the enlargement negotiations is likely to take a certain amount of time, for all the reasons I've mentioned. And in the meantime, we continue and need to engage with Turkey as an important partner in the region, a close neighbor, and a country whose future is extremely important to us.
We've watched the pressure that's been put on Turkey from the Syrian migrants, from the Iraqi migrants. What would be the implications for Europe were Turkey to ever fail?
Well, I mean, frankly, the failure of any country on our frontier is hugely dangerous for us, of course. I don't think Turkey will fail. But I agree that Turkey is going through a challenging moment, and we need to do all we can to support the Turkey and the Turkish people in coming through this in the best way possible. So I agree that if something went terribly wrong in Turkey, it would be extremely bad news. By the way, not just for Europe, but more generally, it's an important partner, for example, as you say, also in NATO. But I frankly don't think. We're quite at that point, but I agree that we need to invest in Turkey, we need to work with Turkey. Turkey is also an accession candidate, but as I emphasize, in my view, these things, you know, it's not completely separate, but the accession process will take the time it takes. And in the meantime, we need to engage with Turkey as a valuable partner in many respects in the region, and as a hugely important country whose future success is absolutely indispensable for us in the region.
So we have time for one more question. I've got three different question cards asking about the climate change talks in December in Paris.
Right.
And let me just sort of put it as a preference. Well, one, what are your expectations there? But also, the EU itself has got very ambitious targets of its own. It's one of the most progressive in the world. What are the chances of meeting those targets as well?
Well, I think climate change is something that people in Europe take very seriously. I can honestly never remember being in Europe and having anyone contest the reality of climate change or the fact that it is generated by human activity and that we need desperately to change our human activity in order to avoid a future catastrophe. And I choose my words very carefully because I think we are potentially facing a man-made catastrophe of enormous proportions if we do not address this collectively. And by the way, the people who will suffer most are the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It will be the developing countries, it will be the small island states, it will be countries with vulnerable coastlines, it will be those countries least equipped to cope with this who will suffer most. And that is why it needs to be a global effort. In Europe, people are willing and ready to make this tremendous change. We have already acting across, you know, every possible sphere, whether it is the issue of fuel efficiency, fuel economy, building efficiency, energy saving, energy security, you know, the whole spectrum of areas in which you can act in order to reduce emissions and move to a green economy where we emit less, where we consume less, and where we consume more efficiently and more effectively, including in terms of waste disposal. And the whole way, it's a whole different way, if you like, of looking at economic growth and at progress, if you like. We need to completely shift the whole economy away from the sort of carbon-hungry fueled which we had for 50 years to a whole new way of looking at it. And I think there's very strong public opinion support in Europe for that, and it's happening on a daily basis almost everywhere I look in Europe, also at the local, in villages, in towns, in cities. I mean, you don't even need government regulations. People are actually actively discussing all the time how you can do this. So I'm absolutely confident we will meet those targets. We may even, frankly, exceed them in due course. In terms of Paris, look, I think the prospects are good. I think there is a distinct sense of much greater engagement of the emerging economies and of the developing countries. We're in much less of a them and us than we were in Copenhagen. And I think the individual commitments which people have made, and we're very grateful to the current U.S. administration, which has made huge efforts, which has shown great leadership, and which has already put on the table a very substantial contribution from the United States. China, other countries are following suit. So I think we're going to be able to have a really good outcome in Paris. With some significant buy-in from the whole international community. I think where Kyoto was frankly divisive. I think we're going to move towards a quite different qualitative sense of commitment. I think we have to be realistic. When you add up everything that everyone promises, probably it will fall below what we know would be needed to prevent the temperature increasing by 2 degrees, which is the sort of critical test. So we're going to need to keep going. And I think we need to view Paris not as an outcome and an end point, but as a platform on which to build with further commitments and further efforts with a review process so that we can squeeze more juice out of the lemon in the years to come so that we really do make a significant impact on the threat that would be posed by significant global warming. And I think that's, so I think it'll be a success in its own term, but it will not be the last word on the issue. We're going to have to keep working on this. But what is really encouraging is just the way the international mood has changed. And I think that's a very positive sign.
Please join me in thanking Ambassador O'Sullivan.
Thank you.